Mr. Harker, I am glad that you have arrived safely. I welcome you to my house. Now, this is a bit of a special introduction to this video from me, because in my eternal arrogance, I set out to make the definitive hammer guide anywhere online. Now, usually with these sorts of things, I back myself, you know, I'm a world-class researcher. You know, what's a couple of hammer horror fans to best? I have to be honest, I have been really quite surprised by the strength and the depth of the Hammer fandom, one of the most robust and dedicated fan scenes I have ever come across anywhere online in all my years running this channel, and indeed just being online or alive in general. The fanzine has been going since 1972. There are reams of books on Hammer, some of which you can see above me here, huge amount of material. And so in order to get anywhere close to my promise of making this anywhere near definitive, I have had to go above and beyond, and I've acquired a lot of materials. I've got things like the contracts of Cushing and Lee for Frankenstein here, letters that were sent by the chairman, James Carreras. I've got, you know, plans for Bray Studios, floor plans, so much stuff. I mean, I've got DVDs coming out of my ears. And as you'll see by the length of this video, this is, I feel a bit like a kind of Hammer producer. You know, the budget has been spiraling out of control. I'm struggling to meet the deadline. I don't know if I'm going to hit the high standards that have been expected of me. But yeah, here I am. It's a little bit longer than usual. And also, I'm going to do a top 10 in a separate video. I thought, well, it's too much for one video to do a top 10. So that's going to be tomorrow. And probably I'm going to do a bit of a collector's guide as a third video in a couple of days, because Hammer is actually surprisingly difficult to collect due to the various distribution deals. But anyway, that's enough from me. I hope you enjoy this one. From 1955 to 1976, Hammer Films, The House That Dripped Blood, frightened audiences, defined a new genre of film, the English Gothic horror, revived horror as a viable box office genre as the Universal cycle had descended into self-parody, by some accounts saving Universal itself from bankruptcy. It revived the British film industry at a time when it was struggling for audiences and relevance, made international stars of Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, brought us arguably the definitive film versions of Frankenstein and Dracula, made over 100 films, averaging about 5 films a year, all on modest budgets and with a framework that has been described as a family atmosphere. Hammer House, based in Wardour Street, is said to have had only 5 staff, that is, 4 directors and 1 secretary. For a decade or so, the dilapidated mansion Down Place in Bray served as one of the most unique studio locations, cramming film sets into narrow corridors and creating Gothic German villages and castles in the middle of Berkshire. While Hammer is viewed as a British institution, receiving the Queen's Award for its contributions to the economy in 1968, no less, and is a beloved part of many people's childhoods, filling many a dark night on BBC Two, or even a rainy Sunday afternoon. As we shall see, it falls a little short of my criteria for vernacular popular British culture, owing to the fact that these films were big around the world, including in America, France, and Japan, and from the get-go had somewhat outsized financial support from America, which some might argue tailored some of its content to the tastes of the American and the international market. Yet, despite all that, these films are quintessentially British, English even. Cut-glass accents, superb, often imperious villains.
Mr. Harker, I'm glad that you've arrived safely.
Count Dracula.
I am Dracula, and I welcome you to my house. I must apologise for not being here to greet you personally, but I trust that you have found everything you needed.
Repeated, dare I say, post-colonial themes of a somewhat Faustian British scientific outlook against indigenous foreign traditions.
Did it ever occur to you that beneath the superficial you've learned about, there could be a great and passionate devotion to this god?
Well, it occurred to me, but I dismissed it.
You're intolerant, Mr. Banning.
Not intolerant, just practical.
All against a backdrop of impossibly buxom women, snarling landlords, angry peasants, drunken coachmen, and the occasional Hooray Henry. This was a fantasy landscape, a fairy tale, a British projection. It was only fitting that alongside Wuthering Heights, Kate Bush immortalised Hammer Horror as something bound to the capital R romantic soul of this country. In the world of Hammer, it doesn't matter if you're in Egypt or, was so often the case, somewhere in rural Germany or somewhere in Eastern Europe. You were basically always in England with a Michael Ripper in every tavern. In this world, Dracula is a British aristocrat, but then so too is the Baron, Victor Frankenstein. In fact, every hero and every villain, pretty much, is a British aristocrat. And come on, let's face it, we absolutely love it. In this video, I endeavour to bring you the most comprehensive introduction to Hammer Horror anywhere on the internet, which is a tall order since, as we shall see later, the resources on this beloved British institution are legion, both in books and here on YouTube. And at the end, I'll share some of those that I have consulted to produce this. However, most guides of this kind tend to focus on the films themselves or try to hook themselves either to the Dracula or the Frankenstein franchises. I am taking a different approach here in focusing on the studio itself, the key people involved in making this massive body of work, its business structures, the reasons for its rise and fall. I will primarily focus on the period 1955 to 1976. This means I will not spend a lot of time on the earliest periods of the studio's life, beyond this briefest of introductions. If nothing else, what I'm about to tell you laid the foundations for making what you can see on the screen possible in the first place. Hammer Films was established in 1936 by a man called William Hines, who used the stage name Will Hammer, hence Hammer Films. He was a businessman with many different companies, including a jeweller's, which you may have heard of, called F. Hines, named after his brother, who co-owned it. He also owned a string of barbershops and many other ventures. Now, according to his son, Anthony Hines, who we will get to know very well over the course of this video, Will Hammer had basically no interest in films.
Hammer was my father, surprisingly enough. He was a successful businessman and a failed comedian. He failed because he wasn't really very funny. But he and another chap did a double act years ago, a comic double act. And because my father's business was centred in Hammersmith, they called themselves Hammer and Smith. And the name Hammer started from that. And he went into financing films before the war. I don't know why, because he hated films.
After an early foray in producing five films in 1935 and 1936, one of which starred horror legend Bela Lugosi in one of film history's happy little accidents, this first version of Hammer Films liquidated in 1937 and became essentially a distribution company called Exclusive, which showed films by other companies. This was technically a separately registered company, which Hines had established with the owner of a chain of cinemas, a Spanish immigrant called Enrique Carreras.
And during the war, a mutual friend introduced him to someone called Enrique Carreras, who was involved in cinema exhibition and distribution. And together they formed a company called Exclusive Films, which just distributed little short films.
Now, Exclusive managed to survive distributing films through the Second World War. It was then that the next generation came through and more or less took over the operation of the company. Enrique had a son called James, who was very entrepreneurial. And as we've already seen, William had a son called Anthony, who was very much more into films than his father. So when the two sons returned from military service after the war, they rejoined the company. James Carreras was very entrepreneurial, as I just said, and in 1946 saw an opportunity to make money from producing rather than merely distributing films through the British quota system. At the time, the British government had mandated that every American film must have a British support feature as a means of protecting the industry. American studios sought loopholes and to make deals with British producers to churn out these films to make the quota, and these became known as quickie quotas. There was a supply issue as British studios struggled to keep up with demand, and spotting this disequilibrium, Carreras thought that Exclusive might exploit this. Hammer Films was thus resurrected with Enrique and James Carreras, along with William and Anthony Hines, as the four directors. Between 1947 and 1955, the new studio banged out 50 or so of these quota quickies, averaging 7 films a year. Since Hammer had to work with American studios in order to fulfill the British quota, Carreras brokered a deal in which Exclusive would gain the rights to distribute the American A feature, which the Hammer B movie supported. He then saw an opportunity to get Hammer's films shown in America on the reverse side of that deal. While America did not have the quota system like Britain, in the late 1940s and the early 1950s, Hollywood famously was in decline during these post-war years, with the encroachment of television on its turf, landmark legal cases which broke up the old studio system, scandals involving organized crime and so on. All of these things rocked the industry, which sent a number of significant studios from so-called Poverty Row into bankruptcy. This meant that American cinemas faced a shortfall in the supply of films, and again, ever the entrepreneur, Carreras spotted an opportunity. Through this period, he scored a key alliance with Lippitt Pictures. Exclusive would distribute their films in Britain, supported by its own films, and by the same token, Lippitt's distribution wing, Screen Guild Productions, would get Hammer's film shown in America. Now, while I have little idea as to the quality of the films of this period, they are important for two reasons for our purposes. First, they gave Hammer a crucial foothold into the American market. It meant that Carreras could make contacts in the massive US market, which he would then later exploit, as we're about to see. Second, it gave James Carreras massive experience in selling films, but perhaps even more importantly, Anthony Hines' massive experience in producing them, along with James's son, Michael Carreras, who joined the company as a director in 1950 to replace his grandfather, Enrique, who had died. This meant that by 1955, when we start our story proper, many of the key personnel had significant film industry experience. Anthony Hines, for example, already had 28 production credits under his belt before he produced the Quatermass Experiment in 1955. Similarly, 1957's The Curse of Frankenstein was director Terence Fisher's 27th film, and this is one of the ingredients that would make Hammer such a powerhouse in the late 1950s and in the 1960s, a tight-knit team of hugely experienced professionals who knew their jobs to expert level and who could deliver again and again. Now, with all of that said, I'll finally introduce you to my contents here. I know we're 10 minutes in, but strap in, friends, this may be a long one. The contents of this video are as such. There's the introduction, which I've just given you. I'm going to introduce you to my comprehensive Hammer spreadsheet, where I have painstakingly, and this took me hours, guys, I've shared this in the show notes, a comprehensive Hammer spreadsheet, which I'll show you in a second. Then we're going to get to know the key personnel in the company. We've met some of them already, but we're going to go into more detail as to who exactly these figures are. Then we're going to have a look at the business structure, particularly some of those deals that James Carrera has made and how he basically single-handedly kept the company in business for many years, for better or for worse, as we'll discuss. We'll talk about the eras of Hammer. I think there are several distinct eras, and how to think about the stages of the company. And also in that section, we'll get into some of the reasons for its rise and indeed for its fall. And then finally, we're going to have a look at a guide to all of the Hammer guides that are out there. And there are a number of excellent books, as well as really, truly excellent videos and documentaries that you can watch here on YouTube. And I'm going to give you a guide to those as well, because this is a huge topic. And this video is intended basically as an entryway. You're basically standing at the bottom of a mountain, and I'm a guide providing you the path and the route to scale the mountain if you want. So somewhat unusually, I'm going to start my guide here with this massive spreadsheet that I've made, which is my contribution. It's kind of my gift to the world of Hammer fandom. If you're a massive Hammer fan, you can download this in the show notes. I've made it available. You're free to edit it, make changes, upload it. I'm just basically giving this away as my contribution to the fandom, as it were, because I was a little bit frustrated trying to find all this information in one place. I mean, it's all out there on Wikipedia, in various books and so on, but I didn't see it all in one place. And I am someone who likes to have a panoramic view. I like to be able to see things from a 10,000-foot level. And then once you see information like this, you can begin to see patterns and draw conclusions and really get a kind of not only a macro, but a micro feel for what was actually happening. I also thought it was important to make this in order to understand the financial side, in order to understand the core creative team, and of course, to have a look at who was in the cast and so on. So the spreadsheet starts in 1955, where Hammer made their big breakthrough into horror with the Quatermass Experiment. This had been a TV show originally, and as you can see, it's the final co-production with Lippert Pictures, which I mentioned already. The director is Val Guest. I think Quatermass was actually Val Guest's 19th film, and he'd already worked with Hammer previously. So they're already, as I mentioned, in this early part, with the Quatermass Experiment, an experienced outfit. It's just that they had turned their hand now to sci-fi horror. Quatermass is a kind of sci-fi horror film, as is X the Unknown. Well, James Carreras, a true entrepreneur, true businessman, thought, well, okay, Quatermass has sold pretty well. It was a reasonably sized hit in Britain for them. Created a bit of a splash. Let's do more of the horror stuff. And so a couple of years later, we get the massive breakthrough, The Curse of Frankenstein in 1957. And this, the importance of this film, not only in Hammer's history, but in film history and horror history more generally, cannot be overstated. The Curse of Frankenstein was basically revitalized horror as a mainstream genre for film. If you have a look at the old Universal Pictures, you know, with Boris Karloff, Bela Lugosi, and so on, you know, they had this kind of brief moment in the sun in the early 1930s. And then there was a lot of sequels that went on, many of them starring Lon Chaney Jr. into the 1940s. But by the end of that decade, they descended into parody, basically self-parody, with things like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, you know, sad picture, really, with Bela Lugosi cropping up as the monster in that picture. And so therefore, by this point, the horror film had basically descended into bargain basement, real kind of bottom of the pile B-movie stuff, Ed Wood, this sort of thing. You know, it was like below poverty row, if that makes any sense. So when The Curse of Frankenstein came out in beautiful color, I mean, if you watch The Curse of Frankenstein on a Blu-ray now, it is a beautiful film. It basically brought back the seriousness of horror again. The fact it was served so straight, the fact it was it took itself seriously. It wasn't a joke. It was in color, like I said. The even though these films were made on a budget, they look expensive and plush. Peter Cushing was just superb as the Baron. Christopher Lee, of course, played the monster in that movie. And so this not only launched Hammer as a serious force in film production, you know, prior to this point, they'd more or less just been keeping going with these quota quickie, the Lippert deal. It really made Hammer a quantity. And it meant that James Carreras could, as you can see from the various co-production deals, with the US distributors here, he had the American market at his feet because The Curse of Frankenstein made huge money. We'll have a look into the box office when we reach the business section, but you know, it reputedly made $8 million on a budget that was much smaller than that. You know, I think it made something like 72 times its budget, which is just huge. Also launched Peter Cushing as an international leading man, star of horror films, and of course the career of Christopher Lee. So, you know, for all of those reasons, The Curse of Frankenstein is arguably the most important film that Hammer made. Second only, really. I mean, the only other film that is of possible equal importance is Dracula in 1958. Which basically showed that The Curse of Frankenstein was not a one-off. And of course, Christopher Lee gave us in that film the definitive Dracula. But as you can see, Hammer at this point was not fully committed to just being like the horror studio. And they carried on their other lines, making comedy films like Further Up the Creek, Further Up the Creek, I Only Asked. You know, comedy actors like David Tomlinson of Mary Poppins fame is in some of these movies, for example. You know, you can see them here. They had a line in war movies that they made, which were, you know, of mixed success, I would say. They made kind of adventure films as well. They always had a line. You can see the Sword of Sherwood there, Terror of the Tongs. So they carried on making comedies, war films, thrillers. There was a variety of different genres in this period, even though these horror films were their big hitters. And you can see the influence of the American money here, where during this whole period, they had a deal with Columbia, which I'll talk about in the business section, where they got co-financing on five films a year with Columbia and various different films with Universal as well, which they basically held back their biggest pictures for Universal because the margins were exceptional on those. And, of course, Universal owned the intellectual property of many of these, like, for example, The Werewolf. They gave Hammer their blessing to take over the horror mantle during this period. And then as we move on, you can see, generally speaking, they move more fully into horror as time goes on and the other strains go away a little bit. And the reason I wanted to make this spreadsheet really is so you can see all of this at a glance, right? You can see when key personnel come and go. For example, Jack Asher here, key cinematographer. You can see basically after 1960, Arthur Grant pretty much takes over. There is one last one for one or two last ones for Asher here, but he's phased out. You can see that generally Anthony Hines was the main producer, but after a certain period, he moves into mainly being a writer and an executive producer. So he's kind of more behind the scenes. And Anthony Nelson Keyes takes over as the main kind of hands-on producer during that point. You can see during this period here that Fox and Seven Arts, this unique kind of three-way deal that Carreras made between 20th Century Fox and Seven Arts, later Warner Brothers Seven Arts, during this whole period here in the mid to late 60s, one of Hammer's most fruitful periods due to the financial security that that deal gave them. And then later on, their deals with EMI during this kind of late experimental period before things finally, kind of the wheels fall off after James Carreras leaves the company. So all this spreadsheet really tells all of that story. Now, in this section, which is going to be fairly lengthy, we're going to be looking at the key personnel in Hammer Films. And I'm going to be taking my time here, so do bear with us because there's a lot to get through. The head honcho at Hammer was undoubtedly James Carreras, later Sir James Carreras, also known as the Colonel because he was a lieutenant colonel in the army during World War II. And really, he made the company tick in a financial sense. He was the one who got financing and made everything else possible. He didn't get very involved in the production side. He wasn't particularly interested in making films. Now, we'll talk a lot more about Carreras in the business structure section, which is a dedicated section later on. But for now, I think it's enough to say that he was known as a showman, as a charmer. He was a salesman to the core. And he had that kind of gift of the gab, that gift of deal making. And that's really what he was. He was commercially minded, a businessman through and through. And to give you a flavor of what he was like, I have a bit of a clip here. And I think you can see for yourself.
The headquarters of Hammer were located in Soho, in an office block proudly named Hammer House. In command of the business operation was Lieutenant Colonel Sir James Carreras.
He was the gardener. Very rarely saw him. I mean, I saw him because I used to work up the office between pictures. But I think the entire time I was at Hammer, which on and off was about 15 years, I think he came to the studios maybe six times. I don't think he was particularly interested in me.
I think it's all come about by the fact that we start with a title. We think to ourselves, what's a good title? And we think, To Love a Vampire. And so then we make a poster. And with this poster, I go around and see these distributors and say to them, how would you like to have a picture called To Love a Vampire? And they say, wonderful, when can I have it? So I say, well, perhaps we can deliver it in about 6 months' time. And I say, you want to see a script or do you want to know who's in it? And they say, no, don't bother about that. This is a Hammer film and we know it'll be all right.
So there you see the general kind of character and attitude of the Colonel. Now, he didn't really get involved in the actual creative side of things or the making of the films. Where he would get involved, basically, is in... I mean, he was notorious for seeing women in, say, a commercial for a perfume or something, or on an advertising billboard, or in Playboy or something. He'd see a woman, and he'd say, "I want that one for the next movie." So he was notorious for finding a sexy woman and plonking her into the movie. And of course, when it came to the top stars, Cushing and Christopher Lee, he was often instrumental in ensuring that they signed on, especially Christopher Lee, who, as we'll talk about later, was kind of reluctant to keep on returning to Dracula. But more or less, he was a hands-off when it came to the movie side of things, very much the businessman and the sales head of the company. Now, his right-hand man on the commercial side was a man called Brian Lawrence. He was the general manager. Now, there's not a lot written about him, not that much known about him, but he was around and he was part of the four directors at the company for a very long time. And later on, in 1980, he ends up taking over, taking the companies into the period where they were producing TV shows and things in the 1980s, which I'm not going to be covering. I'm mainly covering the main film studio here. Now, if Carreras was the chief commercial head, the creative head was Anthony Hines. He was the main producer. He was the writer on many of the films, the screenwriter. Even on those ones that he did not write, he went through the script with a fine tooth comb. He would make a lot of changes, sometimes to the chagrin of the actual screenwriter. Famously, there was a case with John Gilling where he wasn't very happy about the changes that Hines made. But basically, Hines had the creative oversight of the entire company for many, many years. He was basically the man when it came to the film production. And then Michael Carreras, James's son, he was the, in this early period in 1955 to 64, he was often the executive producer on the movies. But really his job, it seems to me, was to oversee the B side, the support features. A lot of the time when it's a B movie, it's Michael Carreras who heads that up. Clearly, Anthony Hines is the one who looks after all of the top properties. And you can see from my spreadsheet in the portfolio, all of the top pictures are Anthony Hines as the producer. Michael Carreras picks up B strand. Probably the top early picture that Michael Carreras had his hand in was The Mummy. For whatever reason, Hines didn't get involved in any of the Mummy pictures. But if you have a look, the Mummy pictures are very often support features. So it kind of fits with the idea of Michael Carreras as the B producer. Now, this takes us up to 64. That's the basic team. Michael Carreras actually fell out with his father in and around 61, 62, and left the company and formed his own company for a while. But basically, he comes back pretty quickly as a freelancer and more or less picks up on what he was doing already. So, he doesn't really leave, if you ask me. So then in 1965, Anthony Hines formally becomes the executive producer with oversight on the entire production cycle. And he stops taking production credits on most of the movies from that point on and focuses on simply writing the screenplays. And the main producer becomes Anthony Nelson Keyes, who had been the general manager at Bray Studios and very much Anthony Hines' right-hand man for many years. So a greatly experienced hand who then steps up to be the main producer. But in truth, even though Nelson Keyes was the name producer, Anthony Hines still kept a very close handle on things. And by all accounts, he was pretty hands-on when it came to this sort of thing. In fact, future AA has a document that kind of shows this in practice. So handing it over to you, future AA.
So I just wanted to pause on this letter. This was from Tony Hines in 1965 on the plague of zombies. And the reason I want to pause on this is because you can see that even though the producer on Plague of Zombies was Anthony Nelson Keyes, it was Tony Hines who was still across all of the detail. It says, when the first print of Zombies was viewed at Technicolor yesterday, it was found that the titles just did not look right. This is something that cannot be judged until one sees the colour print, and some of the scenes need regrading. The reason for the delay in delivering Zombies was that when the picture came off the floor and was cut together and viewed, it just wasn't good enough. I therefore instructed Needs to cancel music and dubbing dates until we worked on the picture to bring it up to standard, for example, revoicing some of the characters. I think this has paid off, and the picture is now not all that bad. We have had none of this trouble with the reptile, and unless there is disaster at the laboratories, it will be delivered on time. And I think this basically shows that even when he was the executive producer, as opposed to the main producer on a movie, Hines was still the man across all the quality control, all the detail, very much the key player in the Hammer team.
Well, hello, this is future AA. You'll be able to tell me by my cool shirt, sporting this Cuban cigar, and the fact that I have this book here, and the fact that it's daytime, causing a kind of AA inception where there are three separate timelines for you to keep track of. It's almost like Doctor Who, when the first three Doctors met each other in that special episode. Anyway, I'll tell you what happened. Basically, all of the things I have here, all of the DVDs and books and so on, they all came together, and one was missing. This one here, Hammer Films, The Unsung Heroes by Wayne Kinsey. This one is so hard to get hold of, I had to get it on US import, and that meant it arrived a week later than everything else. But there is stuff in here that I think it's quite important to add. So annoyingly, even though I already uploaded the video and had it in post-production and everything, I come back to add in these parts. This is what Michael Carrere said of his father, James. He was a salesman par excellence, a man who they say could sell refrigerators to the Eskimos, and he had a tremendous and outgoing personality. When I was a child, I think a lot of my energy was drained just by watching my father perform. He was a great sportsman, a great cricketer, a great rugby and football player, never used to stop. He also loved social occasions, and he was at ease in any class of society or any size of group. This was illustrated very much by his activities in the Variety Club, which developed later. He was an incredible extrovert, as opposed to the older generation. Actor Christopher Lee agrees. Jimmy Carreras was a businessman and a brilliant entrepreneur. He was a brilliant salesman and a brilliant showman. And believe me, we sadly need people like him around today to try to get this industry back on its feet. And Jimmy was a genius at this sort of thing. So Past AA just said that there's no information on Brian Lawrence, or there's very little information. Just so happens that Unsung Heroes by Wayne Kinsey does have a bit on Brian Lawrence. Says he joined Exclusive Films in 1945 after having previously worked for the Anglo-American Film Corporation. He was first employed as a junior salesman and assistant to Jack Spratling, Exclusive circuit manager. Exclusive offices were situated in Nasreno House, later to be renamed Hammer House, after the acquisition of the building by William Hines. When Jack Spratling departed, Colonel James appointed myself and Morris Young to sell the product, mainly short and old British and American reissues, to the London circuits, Odeon, Gaumont British and ABC. It was James Carreras who gave me the opportunity to build up Exclusive's distribution network. I was promoted to general sales, then to general manager, and eventually I joined the board. I had 100 personnel in Wardour Street and our offices and staff in the other major cities. But with the divorce of the Hammer product to the large distributors in return for their investment, Exclusive ultimately became starved of films. And that's, of course, when they started making their own movies, because he joined very early. We just went through that history. As a Hammer director, Lawrence helped to create the group of bird companies, Falcon, Jackdaw, Swallow, Merlin, Kingfisher, Sparrow, Woodpecker, Hawfinch and Cormorant, to absorb the company's losses and Sir James's colourful expenses. Other subsidiaries included Cadogan, Clarion and Hotspur, and all these names would often be seen in the credits of the films. Hammer would buy the name of a bankrupt company, often for a single film, the carrot being that the acquisition was tax-free. The following list of films were shot. So they had this deal where Brian Lawrence would set up subsidiaries to eat up costs of various different things. So, and then there's a list of all of these different subsidiaries that were set up. As the company continued to establish itself, the corporate Hammer of the 60s was essentially Sir James, Tony Hines and Brian Lawrence. And it was also Lawrence who suggested that Hammer should apply to the Queen's Award, which we just talked about, to industry in 1968. In 1971, when Hammer's horrors were becoming exhausted, Lawrence suggested they produce the big screen spin-off of On the Buses, which became the most successful film at the UK box office in 1971, beating the likes of Diamonds Are Forever. Crazy to think about On the Buses scoring better than James Bond at the box office. As Hammer continued to slide in the 70s, by December 1974, Lawrence had had enough and resigned as Hammer director, being replaced by Roy Skeggs. He formed his own company, Tintern Productions Ltd, which continued to look after Hammer's concerns by collecting their royalties. After Hammer became bankrupt in 1979, he and Skeggs became the nominee directors of the new Hammer that went headlong into two TV shows, Hammer House of Horror in 1980 and Hammer House of Mystery and Suspense. Lawrence left the company in 1985 and he died in 2004. And that is the most amount of information on Brian Lawrence anywhere, friends.
So now we can move on to the final iteration when Michael Carrera stepped up as the managing director. In the early 70s. I'll tell that story a little bit later. And basically, Anthony Hines and Anthony Nelson Keyes both leave, and Ada Young becomes more or less the B producer, and Roy Skeggs steps in as the main producer. And in fact, Brian Lawrence there, who you can see on the right, and Roy Skeggs end up taking over the company when it goes into administration in 1979, and Michael Carrera steps down, and it's then Skeggs and Lawrence who go on to produce the Hammer House of Horror TV show in the 1980s. So that is the final iteration. But for all intents and purposes, the main team are these guys here that you see, James Carreras, Michael Carreras, and Anthony Hines, with help from Anthony Nelson Keyes. Keyes is there in the earlier period as well. He's just not in the top positions. So with that said, we're going to have a closer look at each one of the key members of the team, and we're going to look at some cast members and actors as well. Like I said, the main man, for my money, at Hammer was Anthony Hines, certainly when it comes to the actual film product itself. James Carreras, absolutely instrumental in the company, but all on the business side, on the sales side of things. Hines was the creative hub. And I don't think any hardcore Hammer Horror fans would disagree with that assessment. If you have a look, as a producer, he worked on every major film in the company's history that were instrumental. The Quatermass experiment, it was Hines who spotted that the TV series, which was hard hitting in 1953, it was he who spotted that as something that could be a hit film, and he developed it. X the Unknown was a good follow-up. Curse of Frankenstein was absolutely revolutionary. Quatermass 2, also a solid film as well. Dracula, of course, revolutionary. And then all of the follow-ups, cemented the legacy of the studio and the future of the studio. So those were all really important works that Hines had a hand in. Even when he wasn't the screenwriter, as I said, he had oversight over the script and actually made quite a lot of changes, much to the chagrin, as I mentioned, of whoever the writer happened to be. And as a writer, he produced these. So Rasputin, Reptile, Frankenstein Created Woman, really interesting film. Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, Taste of the Blood of Dracula. He's the writer on quite a lot of films as well. Anthony Hines, absolutely instrumental. Next really important person who I haven't mentioned so far is Jimmy Sangster. You saw a little clip of him when he was talking about James Carreras there. He was the main screenwriter for Hammer, especially in their hot streak in that kind of early gothic horror period. He wrote Curse of Frankenstein, he wrote Dracula, he wrote Revenge of Frankenstein, he wrote The Mummy, he wrote Brides of Dracula, numerous other films as well. He, for some reason, moves away from gothic horror after about 1960. Really, after about 1960, he does a lot of other sorts of things. Maybe he just kind of became less interested in gothic horror. But Sangster is, along with the director Terence Fisher and Anthony Hines, typically seen as one part of the holy trinity of the creative team at Hammer. It's usually looking for Fisher as the director, Hines as the producer, and Sangster as the writer. And in many of the books I've got, it is usually talked of as a threesome in that way, especially for those key early films, Frankenstein and Dracula. So speaking of the Holy Trinity then, Terence Fisher is the key director. Now, Fisher had already, as I mentioned, directed 27 movies before he came to direct The Curse of Frankenstein, and he had been an editor before that. So he was a technician, he was a workman, and he was a professional who really knew the ropes before he turned his hand to the gothic horrors here. And as you can see, all of the important early films, Frankenstein, Dracula, The Mummy, and then the follow-ups, I think he directed 5 of the Frankenstein movies, so Curse of Frankenstein, Revenge, Frankenstein Created Woman, Must Be Destroyed, and Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell. He directed all of those, as well as Dracula, The Brides of Dracula, and Dracula, Prince of Darkness, and then other really key movies in the Hammer canon. The Devil Rides Out was directed by him, and Hound of the Baskervilles was his. The Gorgon, another really interesting film. So Curse of the Werewolf, which is highly rated by Hammer, didn't do that well at the box office, but is very highly rated by fans. So Terence Fisher basically invented the gothic horror style of Hammer. He is an interesting director because it's often talked about, like, is he just a technician? Is he just a workman getting the job done, working on, working to the order of the producer? or is he an auteur? And that has been a conversation film and horror fans have been having literally right back to the early 1970s. That conversation has been had about Fisher. What I would say is that he has a kind of interesting, almost like a stately style. He's slow, you know, not in a hurry, Terence Fisher. And his films always have a slow build. They take a while to get going. In the Dracula movies, often Dracula, Christopher Lee, doesn't even turn up for the first like half an hour, 40 minutes. There's a lot of stage setting, a lot of scene building. All of the Frankenstein movies have I would describe it as a stately pace. You know, they're just getting, they take time to build. And he also has this, the camera echoes that general feel. You know, there's not too many jump cuts in Fisher. He doesn't have quick sweeping pans or anything like that. It's usually a slow pan, if he pans at all. Sometimes his camera is static. And I've actually read a lot of interviews with Fisher in that there's a fanzine called Little Shop of Horrors, which went right back to 72. So Fisher was alive while it was going. And he is adamant that these are deliberate, creative choices on his part. You know, he was sometimes criticized for not using the full range of tricks available to a director, but he had a very definite view about what he wanted to do, about what his mise-en-scene was, and about, you know, this slow pace that we're talking about. And he talks about it in his interview. So I lean on the side of thinking of Fisher as an artistic director as well, you know, not just a journeyman, not just a workman. And I think it's really obvious in the overall kind of, when you look at Hammer zoomed out, when you look at all 100 films in this period, Fisher's films really stand out for having a particular atmosphere, tone, and almost a poetry about them. So they really do stand out, the Fisher movies. And when people think of a Hammer horror, quote unquote, typically they're thinking of a Terence Fisher film. Nine times out of ten, I'd have thought. So another director who came in and did quite a lot of the support features, the B-movies, Plague of Zombies was a B-movie, Reptile, Mummy Shroud was a B-movie, was John Gilling. Now, a lot of the accounts that I've read suggest that Gilling was kind of a surly fellow, quite short-tempered, could be quite quick with people. But he, you know, Plague of Zombies is pretty much a masterpiece. I would suggest Reptile's a really interesting film as well. And Mummy Shroud probably is the best of the Mummy movies too. So I don't know. Gilling, I think, is a capable second director. He was clearly heading up the second strand of movies when he was around, and that was his job for the studio. But he was a very capable director, I think. And, you know, he gets quite a lot out of not very much, in especially those two, Plague and Reptile, and Mummy Shroud as well. So, the earlier adventure films, Shadow of the Cat is not bad as well. Shadow of the Cat is definitely worth a look, I would say. Not a bad resume for Gilling there. Another key director who comes in, more or less as a Fisher replacement, I would say. He kind of replaced both Fisher and Gilling when he comes in, is Roy Ward Baker. He did The Quatermass in the Pit, a movie with a big reputation. Vampire Lovers, which has its fans, Scars of Dracula, which I think is one of the weaker Draculas personally, Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde, which has big reputation among Hammer horror fans, and The Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires, which, despite its unusual premise, you know, basically Dracula goes to Hong Kong, literally merges into this kung fu Chinese guy, and I mean, it's basically Dracula with kung fu, with an old Peter Cushing hanging around as well. Sounds bonkers, but the film is a lot better than it seems. I mean, the Shaw brothers were, you know, legends in their craft. Hammer were legends in their craft. And for some reason, that film works better than you'd expect. And I watched a lot of top 10 review shows, and a lot of people put Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires in their top 10 for Hammer. So it has a... I wouldn't even say it's underrated, because it has, among in the fandom, it's highly rated. So Roy Ward Baker arguably has basically no weak films there, apart from arguably Moon 02. You know, I could leave that one myself. But yeah, pretty good director. Next really key person in the early Hammer oeuvre is Jack Escher, the cinematographer on those famous gothic horrors that Terence Fisher directed, on Curse of Frankenstein, on Dracula, on Revenge, on The Mummy. And those films are beautifully lit. Jack Escher had a particular style. He used light, colors in his palette. So he, you know, douse a scene in green or in red or in purple or whatever. And it gives the films this really ethereal, you know, mystical, romantic quality. And they just look gorgeous, these late 50s films. The ones with Asher as the cinematographer in particular, they just look amazing, especially if you get them on Blu-ray. So I would say that Jack Escher was an artist. He was truly an artist. And apparently he was a perfectionist. And this is actually the reason that the company let him go. They couldn't afford to the time that he required. They were working to a quick schedule a lot of the time. I mean, many times Hammer would make, you know, they'd work 6 weeks on one film. There was like a 2-day turnaround. And within the space of a week, they'd be working on a second film. And Jack Escher apparently just took too much time, and they didn't have time for that, which is a shame, I think, because he was an artist, I would suggest. And if you want to have a look at the best of his work, I would suggest The Mummy from 1959. Just looks so good, and some of the set pieces in that film are amazing. Brides of Dracula looks great as well. So, yeah. Now, he was replaced pretty much by Arthur Grant as the main cinematographer. Now, Arthur Grant, as you can see, was with the company before, but he was much better at working quickly, right? They needed to turn things around quickly, and Arthur Grant was noted for his efficiency in getting the shot out there, but a very different lighting style to Escher. He was much more realistic in his lighting. Escher uses those kind of those colors, like I said. So there's a definite change in the way that the Hammer films look when Grant takes over as the cinematographer. But I would say that a lot of these films look great as well. I mean, Plague of the Zombies is a great-looking film. Witches looks great. I mean, lots of them are good-looking films. It just kind of loses that tinge of poetry and romance that Escher brings. But Grant is perfectly serviceable. And in terms of the total number of films that he was the director of photography, certainly he has the most, as you can see there. And many of them absolutely key films in the Hammer back catalogue. Nether, absolutely essential member of the Hammer team, was James Bernard, the composer. He was responsible for many of the scores. I mean, as you can see from the spreadsheet, if you peruse it, there was a number of composers that they had, but their top man was definitely James Bernard. And he is a more interesting composer than you might think. He had some appreciation for the avant-garde, and he experiments and uses rather unusual things right through his career. For example, in Plague of the Zombies, which has got this kind of crashing, awful-sounding main theme, apparently he asked the violinist to play the violin the wrong way around. He was constantly doing things like that. So really quite unusual. Or he'd deliberately used off keys on the piano and things like that. So interesting director and a lot of memorable themes. I mean, everybody remembers the one from Dracula, but all of his themes are add to the atmosphere, absolutely crucial part of the Hammer team. And if you see, he stayed with them right from the start to the end, 55 to 74, look. Another person who is arguably as important as Peter Cushing or Christopher Lee or any of the other members of the team was Bernard Robinson, the set designer, the production designer. Many of his sets are as famous or they add as much to the films as any other component. Now, he was particularly important because Hammer didn't have a lot of budget to work with, yet he was able to make sets that looked expensive, that looked absolutely fantastic. For a long time, they were at a place called Bray Studios, and Bernard Robinson constructed a medieval, late 18th century, 19th century European village in the lot of Bray Studios. And it's fascinating to read about how that village developed. So Hammer would often use the same sets on different films, or they'd use the same basic setup and then they'd change the dress of the set. But, you know, essentially the set was built and they'd just modify a few things. Well, there was this one village set that was stayed there for some years, but Robinson kept on adding to it. And, you know, in one, there'd be like a fort that he built. There was a moat added. You know, there was an inn. There was all sorts of things that he kept on adding to this village. And it's just fascinating to watch it evolve and change over time. This guy obviously was a genius at his job. And it's interesting, a little bit later on, we'll be looking at a few of the budgets for the films. And you can see that as much was allocated to the set as was to the actors. So they did give him some money to play with what little there was. But he made that little go a very, very long way, especially given at Bray, they didn't have a lot of space. It was a small studio by film standards, and they only had four stages. So very often they'd have to turn a set around. They have to erect the set and then strike it down and build a new one, over the course of 4 weeks. And he did that time and time again. And, most people would never even notice that it's just the same place over and over and over again. And yet, that's testament to Robinson. A little bit later on, I'm going to talk through some of that stuff in more detail. But one argument people have is that when Robinson died in 1970, that was one of the key factors in the end of Hammer as we knew it, because he was so important. Another important figure was Les Bowie, who did the special effects, made a lot of the monsters. Les Bowie later worked on Star Wars and various other things. I think he won Oscars and awards for his work. But he had his own company, but Hammer used him and his company a lot to do their special effects. Another key person was Roy Ashton, who was the makeup artist. You can see him working on Cushing there. He was with the company for a very long time too. Now, let's get on to some of the cast members. Undoubtedly, the star of Hammer and the most important star of Hammer was Peter Cushing. He was there, Victor Frankenstein, the Baron, right from the start in Curse of Frankenstein, all the way to the bitter end. But it doesn't matter if he was coming in as the villain, as he was in the Frankenstein films, or as the hero, as in Dracula, where he is Van Helsing. He can play face or heel, if you want to put it that way, and he is equally adept at both. One of the things that Cushing was famous for was bringing his own props to set, which sometimes surprised his fellow actors and even some of the crew. But he was known for being meticulous. There are copies of the scripts where you can see how closely he'd work on the script, and he made lots of notes in the margins and things like that. Really cared about his work, and he took it seriously as well. I've read interviews where he said, you know, there's no time for joking around or messing about on these films. So he was a professional in that respect. And he took his characters seriously. And I think that sense of seriousness and dedication often elevated material that some may argue that Cushing was above. You know, he was that good that he could elevate an entire production just by his presence. And by all accounts, he was a pretty bankable star. I mean, The Curse of Frankenstein made a lot of money, but a lot of these other films made a profit as well. Now, in preparation for this, I watched through all of the Cushing Frankensteins, and some of the performances are fantastic. He is especially good, I think, in 1969's Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed. If you haven't seen that one, I would recommend seeking that out. He is a bastard in that film. Icy cold, you know, taciturn, you know, just chillingly evil in that film. You know, he's very good at that icy cold villain, but he's equally good when he needs to be, when he's a hero and he's more kind of fatherly in a way, and he needs to, you know, he's got that side of him as well that comes out in some of the, you know, when he's with the female lead as Van Helsing in the Dracula films. He's pretty versatile. I mean, in Twins of Evil, he plays this kind of Puritan character. He's pretty menacing in that one as well. So, yeah, Cushing is superb. Really good actor. Probably the best actor that Cushing had, that Hammer had. I would argue that Cushing is probably a better actor than Christopher Lee was, you know, when all is said and done. And without doubt, he was the star. Arguably, without Cushing, Hammer wouldn't have been possible because he carried so many films. But of course, the big villain for Hammer was Christopher Lee, Count Dracula himself, much to his own Trugin. One thing I will say, if you watch enough Christopher Lee interviews and commentaries and things, as I have done, he doesn't half moan a lot. Oh, he was always moaning about something. You know, he was a bit of a purity spiral, in my opinion, Lee. Legendary, though he was, and awesome guy. I mean, he could speak five languages. He was an amazing swordsman. He could do it. He could sing. He could do everything, this guy. He was a genuine aristocrat as well. So, you know, there's a whole video that the future video I can make about Christopher Lee himself. But in terms of his Hammer output, I mean, obviously everybody will remember Dracula. I think his characterization of Dracula is underrated in some ways for the fact that he's quite normal and natural. I mean, I played that clip at the start, Mr. Harker, you know, pleased that you've made it, welcome to my house, etc. He's not mannered when he talks. And I think that his kind of normalcy and sense of kind of, he has a kind of charm. He's not doing the Bela Lugosi, you know, I am Count Dracula, ha 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 ha. He's not doing any of that stuff. And it's kind of disarming when he does talk. Now, in a lot of his films as Dracula, he doesn't actually talk. Doesn't he just kind of hisses all the way through Prince of Darkness. Repeatedly, that was because he hated the script and refused to say any of the lines. That is denied by the writer, Jimmy Sangster, by the way. But Lee maintained that he just wouldn't say the lines. He doesn't really speak much in Dracula Has Risen from the Grave either, or in Taste the Blood of Dracula. So, yeah. So that's his Dracula appearances. There is also the fact that he plays the monster, the creature, in Curse of Frankenstein, and he plays the mummy in the first Mummy film. It's often forgotten that he plays the mummy. Now, he doesn't do a lot of monster roles, just those two, but he is really good as both of those. His Frankenstein's monster is just pitiable. And there's a real pathos in the way that he plays him. You just kind of, he's just pathetic in a way. And you feel for him, even though he's this, you know, kind of brain damaged monster. You do feel for him, and his performance as the mummy is extraordinary as well. You know, you can only see his eyes in that film, but he's sad. You know, he's been in that tomb for 1,000 years, but there's still a human being under it. So those are really good Christopher Lee performances, in my opinion. He's kind of chews up a bit of scenery in Rasputin, which a lot of people say is a great performance of his. Devil Rides Out, of course, is a fantastic film. I think Taste the Blood of Dracula is not on this list. But that's an interesting one as well, by the way. Yeah, Devil Rides Out, good commanding performance. I mean, he has a very solid Hammer career here. I mean, generally, if Cushing or Lee is in the Hammer movie, it's a good one. I'm looking here to see if there's any. I mean, only She really is a definite dud in my book. I mean, She has got its fans. I am not one of them. But generally, lots of good films there. Barbara Shelley is probably the queen of Hammer, queen of Hammer horror. Now, she only did the 7 films, which is quite a lot by female lead standards. A lot of the women come in, they do 1, at most 2, films, sometimes they'll do 3, but more or less they're 1 and done or 2 and done. Barbara Shelley, she stuck around a lot longer and was in a number of good films. I mean, Dracula, Prince of Darkness is a good performance from her. She's good in Rasputin. She's good in Quatermass in the Pit. And she's good in The Gorgon as well. Kind of a beautiful woman as well, in my opinion. And definitely the best leading lady for Hammer. She brings a kind of sense of dignity and control to things. And when she becomes the vampire in Prince of Darkness there, she shows a different side too. So, yeah, rightly legendary actress. Another kind of underrated presence in the Hammer films is André Morel. Now, he was a well-known actor at the time, well-known leading man. And often, if they couldn't get Cushing or Lee, or if they needed somebody for a support feature, they'd bring in André Morel. Like, as you can see, he's the lead on Plague of Zombies and Mummy's Shroud there. He's a very assured and classy presence, in my opinion, André Morel. And when he's around, you don't really miss Cushing or Lee. You know, sometimes if a Hammer film doesn't have either Cushing or Lee, you're thinking, oh, here we go. But if André Morel is there, he anchors everything because he is a strong enough actor in his own right to carry the film. So, yeah, he is definitely worth noting. Another person who has a surprisingly large Hammer resume is Oliver Reed, who got his start in The Curse of the Werewolf, a film that he famously got when he was only 22 years old, and he got it by lying about his age. And I think he got paid something like £90, or some ridiculously low fee for that film. But Reed got his start by Hammer, and he was in a lot of the experimental films of the early 1960s. I'll talk more about the eras of Hammer later on. But some of these films are pretty interesting. I mean, Captain Clegg is an interesting movie. Paranoiac is an interesting film. Well worth checking out. I mean, The Curse of the Werewolf has its fans too. For me, it's one of Fisher's weaker Hammer films, in my opinion. But Ralph Bates was tipped to take over from Cushing and Lee, and they were trying to build him up as a star, and he got quite the push in the early 1970s there with Taste the Blood of Dracula, Horror of Frankenstein, where, I mean, you could see that they were planning to bring him in as Dracula, but the studio demanded that Lee would be on that film, and he actually does play Victor Frankenstein in the Horror of Frankenstein. Not one of the better Frankenstein movies, sadly. And then Lust for a Vampire and Jekyll and Sister Hyde both have their fans, as does Fear in the Night. So pretty, Ralph Bates, for my money, is a pretty good actor. And he definitely, had Hammer gone on, could have been developed as a key figure for them. But the fortunes of the studio cut that experiment short. Had to mention Michael Ripper. He is pretty much every, coachman or landlord or policeman, or there's usually some role for Michael Ripper, who Christopher Lee said in interviews, if there's any one person who embodies Hammer, most important person there, it was Michael Ripper. He was like the bit part king. He is a very familiar face. I've also mentioned Dodgy Foreigners. This was a kind of strand where sometimes the villain in a movie would be a dodgy foreigner. Usually they'd use Marn Maitland, who was actually Indian or half Indian, I believe. Or they'd use George Pastel, as you can see him there in The Mummy. And I actually think both of those are pretty good actors. Later on, Roger Delgado, who is famous from Doctor Who as the Master, he comes in to some of those movies as well. And I think they're a kind of underrated part of Hammer. Who cares about political correctness? These guys, they fulfill their roles pretty well. Another really key part of Hammer, of course, is the buxom beauties, the ladies. Carolyn Monroe went on to do Bond. Ingrid Pitt carry some of those Karnstein trilogy films. Martin Beswick, who has a kind of dominatrix thing about her. She has one great turn in Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde. Valerie Leon, famously of the Big Bosoms, she came in. And Veronica Carson was quite the beauty as well. So, I mean, there are many other buxom beauties. Obviously, Raquel Welch and Ursula Andres, and many girls who did Hammer also did a Bond film or became a Bond girl. There was quite a lot of crossover there. They were just around at the same time. So, that's a big part. And as I mentioned, James Carreras would often request certain girls that he'd seen, you know, on a poster or in an advert, and he'd get them in. Now, very often, some of those girls were models and had never acted a day in their lives. So they can be dubbed, or they're really ropey or whatever. So sometimes there are some pretty dodgy performances. But these ones here are all pretty decent actresses, I would argue. Ingrid Pitt and Beswick and Monroe, certainly. Veronica Carson's pretty good too. And for what it's worth, I think Valerie Leon holds her own in that Mummy film. Not just because you're looking at the massive knockers.
So just as how committed Carreras was to what was known as Hammer Glamour, he had this idea in 1970 of creating the screened new sex symbol of the 1970s, developed with Columbia. And it was basically a kind of search for a new hottest woman type thing, almost like an apprentice deal where Jimmy Carreras would go out and hold this competition to find a new screen beauty. And the winner of the competition would star in their new Stone Age adventure, Creatures the World Forgot. Carreras explained it all in a BBC promotional interview. It all started in trying to get a repeat of the success of 1 million years BC, in which we introduced Raquel Welch as a sex symbol and world star. We were thinking of another title and came up with Creatures the World Forgot and an illustrated poster. I went round to see the people at Columbia. They liked the idea, gave us the go-ahead and the money to make the picture. Then, with the publicity experts at Columbia, we decided to run a contest to find a new Raquel Welch. Columbia circulated through their offices all over the world, through newspapers, television and radio, that Hammer were looking for a new Raquel Welch. And we must have had 2,000 replies, and from all of those, we narrowed them down to 280 girls who came to my office from all over the world. What a great job that was, I'm sure, for him. And then one day, Julie Edge walked in, and that was the end of the search. She was so outstanding that we decided there and then that this is who we wanted. And here's a picture of Julie Edge. I'm going to flip it on top of my ugly mug, and you can see she was a stunner.
So definitely I would say that Hammer had an A-team, okay? Terence Fisher, the director, Anthony Hines, the producer, Sangster, the writer, the Holy Trinity there, okay? With either Cushing or Lee as the star, Jack Asher as the cinematographer, and James Bernard as the composer. If you have those, some combination of those names associated with the film, you're looking at top-tier Hammer, 9 times out of 10, I would say. You can use the spreadsheet to work out how many times these guys actually worked in this configuration. But if you take either Cushing or Lee, I think there's a significant body of work there for those six as the A-team. Now, as time goes on, the A-team changes a little bit. Obviously, Hines moves across to being the writer and the executive producer, as we talked about. Grant comes in for Asher, and Nelson Keyes comes in for Hines. But there's quite a number of films that have this as the configuration, and those are all pretty decent films as well, I would say. So definitely Hammer had, and this is not just from a quality fan point of view. I think within the planning of the films, you can definitely see that they had an A squad and then like everything else that was going on. And this was the A team. This was like their big hitters that they planned everything else around. B team was basically Michael Carreras is, you know, I would say Michael Carreras, the king of the B strand. And this is a list of all of the films that he produced. And you can see that he actually played outside of horror quite a lot. And my impression is that Michael Carreras always wanted Hammer to be more than just horror or more than just gothic horror. He was never happy just going all in on Frankenstein and Dracula. He wanted to have a diverse portfolio. And this is where he fell out with his father quite a lot, because his father was just following what was hot as somebody with a, you know, who was sniffing the trends and giving the people what they wanted. Michael Carreras was always trying to branch out in new directions and experiment, often with disastrous consequences. Often his projects would fail or would bomb or whatever. But he did have a couple of big hits. 1 million years BC with the famous Ray Harryhausen dinosaurs, that made a lot of money. I think it probably was the biggest hit that Hammer ever had, was 1 million years BC. And Carreras was able to develop a whole kind of string of hits out of that. Later on, under Michael Carreras's tenure, the movie version of On the Buses was actually one of Hammer's biggest ever earners, if not the biggest ever earner that they had. So he did prove his point once or twice that working outside of horror, the company actually made money. But for every one of those, I would say there were probably three or four misses that he had as well. So, but anyway, Michael Carreras, you can notice the directors on those, like his teams move about a lot more. There's a lot more variety in the names that you see on the kind of B movies. But they're never terrible, I would say. The Lost Continent is a film that I've only seen a review of, but it looks bonkers. I haven't managed to watch it yet, but that's one that is on my to-do list because it seems positively crazy. Vampire Circus is a mental film as well. So, Michael Carreras, the king of the B strand. It is now time for me to have a look at the business structure of Hammer and how exactly the company worked. Really, we're looking at the strategies of Sir James Carreras. Carreras aimed for a 25% margin on every film. In 1947, he calculated that a second feature would make around £25,000 in revenue, and therefore he set budget at a £20,000 ceiling per film with the aim of making five a year for £25,000 profit a year. This ratio was adjusted as time went on, but his general strategy was to seek a co-production deal with a US partner plus a distribution deal. This meant most Hammer films were co-financed, with Hammer taking 33%, the co-producer 33%, and the distributor 33%. So you can see that James Carreras basically, when he kind of gave statements to the press and things, was always selling what Hammer were currently doing as their strategy. So in 1958, when they were making all these different films, he says, "Do not imagine our policy of exploiting a formula ties us to any one particular type of subject. Our job is to keep one jump ahead of public taste, to pioneer new tastes.
We have built up a big story property reservoir. The moment audience reaction shows the slightest hint of staleness, the formula can be switched overnight. We have become famed for our horror films, but we can turn to comedy, social drama, historical pictures, or musicals at a moment's notice. That is a measure of our organisation's flexibility. So you can see there in 1958, he wasn't thinking of Hammer as a horror studio in particular, and was touting how quickly they could change up. Neat little bit of insight here from Anthony Hines on how James Carreras would operate. He says, Hammer never had any policy other than to keep going at minimum financial risk to ourselves, says Tony Hines. We lived hand to mouth. I cannot remember that we ever made much profit, certainly not from America. But if you know anything about the way American majors operate, this will come as no surprise to you. But then I don't remember that we made any losses either. Our method of operation was this. Every year, Jim Carreras, who was Hammer Films, was to go to New York, having arranged to meet the top men of the big distribution companies, Fox, Universal, Warner, MGM. Before leaving, he would ask around for ideas for future movies. These could be scripts or stories submitted, performed plays, spin-off from TV shows, or, this was generally the case, just an idea or even a title, Creatures the World Forgot, The Day the Earth Cracked Open, and that sort of thing. He would select the ones he fancied stood the best chance and have our poster artist produce posters illustrating the action as he saw it might be, and he was very good at this. Jim would then take these to his meetings and produce them, saying, how do you fancy this one? We could make it for you for X thousands of dollars. He would then telephone me, or Michael Carreras, if he were the acting as executive producer at the time, saying which he would be able to sell and when they wanted delivery. He would then work out a schedule to fit and get cracking on the script. He would then telephone me or Michael Carreras, if he was acting as executive producer at the time, saying which he had been able to sell and when they wanted delivery. We would then work out a schedule to fit and get cracking on the scripts. The distributors would pay one third of the production cost on signing, another third on the first day of production, and then the final payment on delivery, provided they were satisfied that we had kept to the contract, delivery on time, correct running time, minus dialogue tracks, etc., supplied exactly as they wanted them with no technical faults. We were once fined heavily for a slight negative scratch, although it had been done by their laboratory, and that is how we operated. The American majors set our policy.
Carreras' basic strategy was to use these co-production and distribution deals to sell Hammer films around the world. According to Little Shop of Horrors 8, published in May 1984, in 1965, 47% of Hammer's earnings were from overseas. And by 1968, this had risen to 82%. And this is why they received the Queen's Award, because in that three-year period, they had bought £5 million into Britain. That is 82.2 million pounds in 2024 money. And after this, Carreras was knighted, hence becoming Sir James Carreras. Now, just to get an idea, you know, he was a smooth talker, he was good at sales, he was good at making deals, but he was also pretty hard-nosed when he wanted to be. And Future AA has a letter that I want to share with you. So over to you, Future AA.
Well, thanks a lot, Past AA. I would say the thing that comes through very strongly in these letters from James Carreras that we have is that he's very particular and very caught up on where the production cash is being provided by various partners. And here, for example, he wants to make sure that if Warners aren't putting up any production money, they need to guarantee 500K in an advance. Similar, and you can see from the tone of this that even though he was a charming businessman and so on, he was pretty hard-nosed when he needed to be. This is a letter from James Carreras to his partners on in 1957 here, where he's saying, look, you are not in this film on Camp of Blood Island unless you contribute half the production cost before Friday, August the 30th, as explained very fully in my letter dated July the 23rd. The snorkel starts on September the 7th. You are not confirmed on this by your cable dated July the 2nd. By not coming in on Camp of Blood Island and the snorkel, you are forced to finance. You've forced us to finance this 100% ourselves, which he doesn't like doing, of course. Therefore, as every major distributor is trying to get the blood of Frankenstein, we are insisting that whoever gets it also takes Camp on Blood Island and the snorkel. By either contributing towards the production cost and thereby buying a percentage of the profits, or on a straight guarantee against distribution. Please read all of this carefully. And you can see he's driving a pretty hard bargain here. He's saying, if you want Frankenstein, you're going to take these two movies too, and you're going to help contribute to the finance. And lo and behold, he got his way. Look, Columbia Pictures happy to announce Hammerfield production coming in with James Carreras, his son Michael, Tony Hines. There you go. And of course, these films were made as well. The sequel, The Blood of Frankenstein, became The Revenge of Frankenstein. That was the working title, Blood. So you can see that Carreras got his way there by driving a hard bargain. Back to you, Pastor A.
Well, thank you very much, Feature AA. I'll hear from you again in a moment. So anyway, after The Curse of Frankenstein made over 70 times its budget, Hammer had a keen interest from big American players. Carreras at this time struck two lucrative deals, both co-finance and distribution packages, one with Universal and one with Columbia. The Universal deal gave Hammer rights to use its famous roster of horror monsters and was highly lucrative.
So you can see here the letter from Universal, the legal letter from Universal to Hammer, basically saying, if you infringe any part of our copyright on Frankenstein, that is, if the monster looks anywhere close to our monster, if any material that originated in our films is there, you're gonna have some damages, basically.
So that was a bit on censorship, how Universal really didn't like, they kept on threatening what Hammer were doing with Frankenstein. But then, when they saw what a big hit it was, they decided that they might as well give Hammer their blessing and get in on the action. And there is a bit on the Universal deal here. It says, Hammer seduced Universal with the success of Dracula when it broke all records after the first week take at Gaumont Haymarket since its opening in 1925. A bank holiday picture that tells its own story, proclaims Cinema Today on the 28th of May 1958. The horror sex blockbuster Dracula at the Gaumont Haymarket was pulling in queues. Business was fantastic, and the film played to packed houses on each of these 3 days of the holidays. Kinematoff Weekly added the following day, in its first 4 days, has broken box office records, realizing the highest ever bank holiday Saturday and Monday figures at the theater. In the US, it was just as successful. The world premiere was held at the Warner Theater, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, under the American title Horror of Dracula on the 8th of May, 1958. And the picture grossed $1,682 on its first day, $10,600 in its first 5 days. The New York premiere followed on the 29th of May at the Mayfair Theatre. It played there for 3 weeks with The Thing That Couldn't Die,
grossing 25 grand in its first week, 17 grand in its second, and 14 grand in its last of the 3 weeks. Couldn't have come at a better time for the then ailing Universal, who were in financial difficulties. Christopher Lee explains, "I remember going with Peter Cushing, Jimmy Carreras and Anthony Hines into the office at Al Daff, president of Universal in New York, who said, 'Gentlemen, your film has just taken Universal out of bankruptcy.' I checked with Jim Carreras, I checked with Tony Hines, I checked with Peter, and I said, 'Am I wrong or did he say that?' And they all said that he did." Hammer's prize was impressive as Universal threw open their vaults to them, an honour unprecedented for such a small, independent British film company. James Carreras told the Daily Cinema on the 20th of August 1958 that Universal have the greatest library of horror classics and shocker subjects of any company in the world, that they should have made this library of over a dozen famous titles available to us is a wonderful honour. Their decision is a measure of their delight at the box office success of Dracula and its quality as a production. Al Daff has told me, personally, that he knows no company in the world that could have delivered a better job. Last night when I spoke to him on the transatlantic telephone, I told him that we already have chosen our first three subjects. They are The Phantom of the Opera, The Invisible Man, and The Mummy. All three will be filmed in Technicolor and will be made at Bray Studios by the same team responsible for Dracula, The Revenge of Frankenstein, and The Curse of Frankenstein." You can hear him selling even as he's talking here. Hammer's choice was perhaps a little predictable. This is the writer now, Wayne Kinsey. And they eventually whittled the shortlist down to the Universal favourite, The Mummy. The Phantom of the Opera would come eventually in 1961. The Invisible Man would sadly never be realised. It was also with Universal that Hammer first established the Hammer double bill, with The Curse of the Werewolf and The Shadow of the Cat. In any double bill, the lion's share of the box office would go to the main feature. A Hammer double bill guaranteed the whole revenue for them and their co-producers and distributors. And then it's got a list of the double bills that they put out during this time. Kind of interesting. Here are a list of all the double bills. The Curse of the Werewolf and Shadow of the Cat in 1961. Phantom of the Opera and Captain Clegg in 1962. Maniac and the Damned in 1963. The Gorgon and Curse of the Mummy's Tomb in 1964. And if you ever see the double bill posters, they're really cool. I can drop in a couple of the posters because I just think they look fantastic, and I would have loved to have gone to see a double bill myself like this. 1964 had The Gorgon, Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, Evil of Frankenstein and Nightmare, Dracula, Prince of Darkness and Plague of the Zombies. That's one I would have loved to have seen in 1966. Rasputin the Mad Muck and the Reptile, also a cracking double bill. Frankenstein Created Woman and The Mummy Shroud. The Devil Rides Out and Slave Girls. Horror of Frankenstein, Scars of Dracula. I bet that looked cool on the poster. Hands of the Ripper, Twins of Evil. Cracking double bill, that one as well. Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde with Blood from the Mummy's Tomb. Mummy always a support feature. And finally, Fear in the Night and Straight On Till the Morning. So there you go. Hammer's double bills. Started with the Universal deal.
While the Columbia deal was an agreement to produce five films a year for 5 years. In addition, Columbia received a 49% stake in Bray Studios, which Hammer had owned since 1951. And this was a neat way for American studios to get around union laws.
Now, in 1964, Carreras was obviously feeling quite bullish, and he made this statement to the Sunday Times. "We have our own studios and control our own finance, and we have distribution agreements with Columbia and Universal. At one time, we made three horror films a year. Now we average about two. After the first idea for a film is born, it's on the floor within 6 months. Shooting takes 6 to 8 weeks, and about 3 months after that, it's out. The so-called crisis doesn't affect us at all in getting the pictures made. We start getting our money back after the London release, and it comes back very quickly when you have a success. If we can get them into the London Pavilion, fine. Otherwise, we don't bother with the West End at all. We believe in following our product right the way through. Our manager incentive schemes offer prizes to managers who present our films with imagination. So the managers look forward to Hammer's programmes. There's always some sort of angle you can exploit. And then he explains why they made these thrillers. He says, as for the thrillers, when Psycho, Hitchcock Psycho, was such a success, we like to think we'd never be far behind in following up good ideas. So we made a quick series, Scream of Fear, Maniac, Paranoiac and Nightmare, and a whole batch of wonderful titles yet to come. You have to couple two X films in a double feature, naturally, and we find that one classic and one thriller make a good combination. Kiss of the Vampire and Paranoiac did well together, and next summer, Evil of Frankenstein goes out with Nightmare. We even started to make comedies, he says. Up the Creek was one of the first films to star Peter Sellers. It was very successful, but we were a bit out of our depth in comedy, and Further Up the Creek was a disaster, he admitted. So, yes, there he is, slightly different than in 1964, than the sort of thing he was saying in 1958.
Now, at this time, I want to talk. I'm going to take a little bit of a time out from the business structure just to talk about Bray Studios. This was a place that they bought. It was called Down Place, and it was a dilapidated... So Down Place was this dilapidated mansion, basically, but for some reason, Tony Hines requested it as the site for Hammer's studio, which became Bray Studios. And as you can see here, they had four stages. Stage one was their biggest one. Then they had two smaller stages, stage two and stage four. And stage three was actually in the house itself, under this archway around there. And the reason they got this studio, it saved a lot of costs for them. If you think about it, they didn't have to pay rent. And as I talked about earlier on, they reuse sets all the time. So there were, you know, cost savings to be had by having their own studio like this. And while we're on the subject of Bray, worth pointing out, you can actually get to know it a little bit by learning the different stages. So this is stage one, and you notice the stairway in the background and the high ceiling. Stage one is the only stage they had that had that kind of height. So it's very often got a staircase in it. Once you get to know this, you can spot it in different films. Now, these are both from The Plague of the Zombies. But here is Dracula, Prince of Darkness. So you can see the same stair. This is the original Dracula from 1958. Notice the height, though. You can always tell if it's stage one, if there's lots of space vertically to play with. Stage two was a smaller space, which is very often used as a study, basement sometimes, something like that. This was actually made out of brick, which meant that it was the only stage they had that could take fire. So they often stage their fire scenes on stage two. These are both taken from Plague of the Zombies. And this is a still from Dracula, Prince of Darkness, also on stage two. You can see it's a nether study. This is from the same movie. They also used it as a basement there. So they often redressed sets in the same way. Here is stage three, which they used. That was the long corridor in the old mansion there, which they actually used to film many of their inn sequences. Very often, the inn or the tavern, you'll notice, has this doorway there. You You can notice the shape of it. This is from Plague of Zombies. This one is from the original Dracula. Notice the same shape of the doorway there. This one is from Dracula, Prince of Darkness. And, you know, once you get to know these, you'll notice the same shapes and the same basic spaces again and again. Now, of course, if you're watching this on TV or in the cinema or something, you'd never notice in a million years. But it is fascinating once you start to take note. Stage four was their smaller stage, and it was typically used for, you know, like a prison cell. For example, I mean, this is a prison in Plague of Zombies. This is a little bedroom in Dracula, Prince of Darkness. Here they've repurposed it as a study. But you can see the sorts of spaces that Stage 4 would take. All right, so that was our little detour to Bray Studios. But generally, this was part of the feel and the charm of a lot of Hammer movies. And some people argue that after they left Bray Studios, which we're about to talk about, the films never quite felt the same again. They lost something. So anyway, this is the pre-production budget for the original Dracula. You can see it cost just under £82,000 there. Now, this film, we know, worldwide made £26 million, so it was a massive hit, made many times more than its budget. One of the things to notice here is the paltry sum given to the artists, less than $9,000 all in for all of the actors. We know that Christopher Lee for Dracula was paid only £750, which in his autobiography he mentions he went and bought a second-hand Mercedes-Benz with that money. Now, obviously, he got paid back in many other ways because it made him an international star and a worldwide name. But yeah, £750 he got paid for that. Peter Cushing, I think, was on something like £300 a day for that film, something like that. So he got paid a little more as the star. Of course, he was coming from off the back of Curse of Frankenstein as well. But also notice the amount of money that is set aside for production, for the sets. Sets and models, 16,800 on Dracula. So double the amount on sets and models than there were on the artists. So that shows you that Hammer took seriously the look of their films in terms of the set design. So they obviously valued that part of it. Now, having a look at the US distributor takings of Dracula, and I sourced these from an academic paper that had been done on it. Now, that is, the source for that is Variety in January 1959. That £26 million figure I gave, obviously, in January 1959, not all the money had been in. So this is a million just after a year or so. Dracula was re-released in a double package with Frankenstein in 1964, I think, where it was a big hit again. And obviously, so all in, it's taken 26 million. Just at this point, it was just a million. And it's a good breakdown of how the percentages worked. So you can see that Universal takes about a third as a distributor. It takes another third as the co-producer of the film. And that leaves Hammer with just about a third, depending on, I mean, there's some details we don't know, which is why there's three different estimates here. This paper is trying to argue that Carrera's deal was not that good because Hammer had to front blowed a lot of the risk. I'm not sure if I quite see it that way, because they got a huge amount of benefits being out. So continuing, after some disappointing box office results in the early 1960s, both Universal and Columbia did not renew their deals. Thus, from 1965, Carreras established a unique new three-way deal with 20th Century Fox as Hammer's new US distributors and Seven Arts Productions under his old friend, Elliot Hyman, who had unofficially co-financed The Curse of Frankenstein in 1957 as well, who would also provide half of the budgets on key titles. Now, it just so happens that we have some box office results of how Dracula, Prince of Darkness, and Plague of the Zombies did. And kind of interesting to dig into this, because one of the things I was trying to understand was the logic of the support feature. And as far as I can make out, Seven Arts only financed Dracula, Prince of Darkness in this double feature. Plague of Zombies was financed just by Hammer alone. So if you have a look at the splits for this, Fox, Seven Arts, and Hammer got 33% each, of course. But because Plague of the Zombies was 30% of the total gate, Prince of Darkness 70% of the total gate, it means that Fox got $531,000 for Dracula, $227,000 for Zombies. Seven Arts got just the $531,000 for Dracula, and Hammer got $531,000 for Dracula and $455,000 for Zombies. So the fact that they made it a double feature actually almost doubled their money on what they would have made from just doing Dracula alone. So when you look at it in that way, the logic of doing double feature, you know, the main, the A film and the B film, or the main film and the support film, actually makes financial sense. So you can see there that in 1966 didn't do bad money. They made 56% more than their budget on that occasion. Just so happens that we have some pretty good breakdowns of that, and once again Future AA has got some extra detail on this one.
Now, for this movie, Dracula, Prince of Darkness, we actually have a breakdown of all of the places in the world that it was selling. Now, this is a update on January 1968, so Dracula, Prince of Darkness came out in 1966, so this is pretty much all it was going to do. And you can see that, yes, it played in the United Kingdom. Yes, it played in the United States and Canada. But also, all of these other markets around the world, just £19 in India. But quite a lot of money in some other markets. If you see, $27,000 in Mexico, look. So you can see, I mean, $51,000 in France. So they were big in France, Hammer Studios. But you can see that they played all around the world, $69,000 in Italy, almost $70,000 in Italy, etc. Now, some of these are in dollars, some of them are in pounds. So, you know, you have to work out currency differences. But, yeah, kind of interesting. Although, as we know, these are not the figures that we saw in the Fox book for Dracula, Prince of Darkness. It did over a million, we know that. So clearly these have had certain divisions or percentages already taken out. All right, back to you, Past AA.
All right, well, thanks a lot. So let's carry on then. And in 1963, Carreras acquired another investment from a British company called ABPC, which later merged with EMI, who also bought a stake in Bray Studios, with the slightly odd proviso that Hammer moved their productions from Bray to their famous Elstree studios. And in 1964, Hammer had already shot a number of films at Elstree, and Bray was going unused, but still costing about £260 a week for maintenance, about 4.5k in 2024 money, or £13,500 a year, which would be £232,600 in 2024 money. Accordingly, 1967's The Mummy Shroud would be their last film at Bray. Now, I was kind of curious about this, that, you know, it would be cheaper for them to rent to Elstree than to use their own studio at Bray. And I understand that the maintenance money was one thing, but having a look at some of the budgets for later movies, I noticed that the rent budget on the studio was 18K, which they wouldn't have spent if they were at Bray. And if you consider they were doing between 4 and 6 movies a year, you times that 18K by 6, let's say, and I don't really know. I feel like they're going to be spending more on the rent than they were spending at Bray, because that maintenance money, whether they use Bray or not, was going to be spent. Okay, but if they were making the movies there, then you're making a significant saving by keeping things at Bray. But anyway, what do I know? All right, so let's carry on. You can see here how Bray was phased out. Mummy Shroud, the last film there in 1966, that was produced, but they'd already started using Elstree way before then. You know, even Maniac was, Taste of Fear, a number of films shot at Elstree. And a lot of people mention, like, various crew say that the reason that Bray was unique was because it was so small, you could only make one film at a time. Whereas at a much bigger studio like Elstree, where they've got, you know, 10 different stages, there could be 2 or even 3 movies being shot simultaneously. And the focus of the entire crew, and that it being the same crew film on film, but the idea of it being the same crew working on the same film at the same time, and everybody focused on one project together, gave Bray this unique family feeling, a kind of tight-knit unit where everybody knew what they were doing. And apparently the move to Elstree scrambled people up a bit more, because you didn't know whether you were coming or going, 2, 3 different films going on, and it broke up that family atmosphere. You know, apparently everybody at Bray, you know, ate at the same canteen. You know, it would be like the tea lady and Peter Cushing in the same queue, you know, and they would all be in the same place. So yeah, something was definitely lost after Hammer left Bray and moved their production to Elstree. Now, in 1969, just as Hammer looked like they were flying high after the Queen's Award and after the knighthood for Sir James Carreras, the company hit crisis. Hammer's key US production partner, Seven Arts, was bought by Warner Brothers in 1967. The relationship continued as it was, and, you know, it became Warner Seven Arts. And you can see on my spreadsheet, a lot of those co-productions continue with Warner Seven Arts as both the distributor and as the co-producer. All that happened really is that they switched from Fox as the distributor to Warner Seven Arts. While, you know, okay, Fox is one of the big five, but then so is Warner. So, you know, it's a like-for-like comparison, really. But then, in 1969, Carreras' key ally, Elliot Hyman, retired. That was his key in there at Warner. And when the new management took over, they didn't know James Carreras. They did not renew the arrangement with Hammer. And, well, you can see, you know, why that would be bad for them. No longer able to rely on his arrangement with Seven Arts, this meant that all new films would have to be negotiated on a film-by-film basis for US distribution, and more crucially, for the co-productions, which, of course, Carrera's always had in mind. With the American film market withdrawing, financing, turning inwards, Carrera's relied on his British contacts in the film industry to leverage new deals with EMI, boasting about 100% British finance, like he was trying to use it as a selling point that this was a 100% British finance movie. And he made partnerships with producers like Harry Fine and Michael Style and some of his horror counterparts in America, like Roger Corman's American International Pictures. That's AIP on the spreadsheet, if you're following along. So that those were kind of new deals that Carreras was making in 69 and 70, which got a number of new movies made. However, 1969 also saw a triple whammy, which hit Hammer's core team, and arguably from which it would never recover. First, Anthony Hines, arguably the most important creative visionary behind the films, as we've already discussed, unhappy with the direction of travel and accused of plagiarizing parts of the script of Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, and worn out from having to work as a producer for the TV series Journey into the Unknown, resigned his position from the board of directors. Without Hines overseeing the production schedule, things would spiral in the 1970s, and that's an understatement. In addition, Hines' long-term right-hand man, Anthony Nelson Keyes, who had been the general manager at Bray back in the day, and the main producer after the move to Elstree, also quit Hammer to form his own production company, Charlemagne Productions, co-founder with Christopher Lee, which only produced one film, Nothing But the Night, in 1972. They wanted to carry on producing classic horror films, but really by 1972, there wasn't a market for it anymore. Finally, set designer Bernard Robinson, arguably as key to Hammer as Cushing or Lee, as we've discussed, died in 1970, making Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed his last film for Hammer. So that's a pretty major loss, I think you'd all agree. So seeing the writing on the wall, Carreras sought to step down and persuaded his son Michael, who he'd always had a difficult relationship with, to take over as managing director in 1971. Now, like I said, they had a difficult relationship, and when Michael found out that his father, Sir James, was trying to sell the company from under his nose in 1972, he took a loan out and bought the company himself, seeking to keep it in the family. So, and he felt pretty betrayed by his father trying to sell the company. Now, I think in the cold light of day, you can see that it was a yet another shrewd entrepreneurial move by Sir James, who was a true businessman. Michael, more sentimental, more creative, didn't see it that way. And, you know, he made an emotional decision, not necessarily a business decision, as we'll see. Michael lacked his father's entrepreneurship, his flair for deal making, and he desperately tried to sell pictures, coming up with dozens of unrealized projects, but to little avail. And one of the tragic things really is that he kept on announcing projects. He kept on saying, oh, this is going into production, Hammer's going to be making this. And then, of course, the films would never come out. He secured a two-film partnership with the legendary Shaw Brothers Studios in Hong Kong, with interesting results creatively, but distribution troubles in the crucial US market undermined these films at the box office. And this is really the story of the late Hammer. They couldn't get decent distribution deals. And of course, if you can't get a distribution deal, you can make the best film in the world. But if only, like, you know, one person is seeing it on a rainy Thursday in Hull. You know, what's the point? Michael even accused his father of trying to undermine him. Basically, Michael accused James of going around all of his contacts in the industry saying, don't help Michael. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. He seemed pretty estranged from his father. But for whatever the reasons, Michael finally stepped down in 1979 as Hammer went into administration. So he couldn't turn things around. Whether it could have been saved, I mean, I feel like had the core team stayed and had James stayed, they had the talent that they would have been able to do something there. Michael, bless him. I feel like he was a guy who, if he hadn't have been part of the Carreras family and if he hadn't, you know, have kind of grown up in the industry as he had, he may have been like an Ed Wood figure or something like that. Maybe that's a little bit harsh, but so I get the impression that he wasn't the most talented in any particular area. Maybe some Hammer fans will take exception to that, but I think it's a fair assessment, objectively speaking. So now we're going to talk about the eras of Hammer. And this is not going to be a particularly long section because I think we've established all of the core details and you can more or less see them there on the spreadsheet that I provided. But from 1955 to 1960, you have the classic Gothic era. This is riding on the wave of the success of The Curse of Frankenstein, followed up by the phenomenal success of Dracula. And they made a number of films in this style. Mummy, there was the Brides of Dracula, Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll. These are all Gothic horrors. Hound of the Baskervilles, if you see it, is very Gothic feel as well. And this really is Hammer's classic period. Lots of the films made here, gorgeous to look at, as I've talked about. And when people think of Hammer horror, really often they're thinking of this late 50s period. Now, in the early 60s, you have what I'm calling the experimental Columbia era. During this period, they had this deal with Columbia where they could rely on distribution and co-production on 5 films a year, which gave them actually quite a lot of safety and leeway to experiment, which they did quite a lot. A lot of these films some of them are pretty different, you know. They made a lot of these psychological thrillers. Apparently that was for the French market. Those films did really well in France. But a lot of these films are strange, you know. Nightmare is an odd film. Captain Clegg is a very strange film. Curse of the Werewolf is different as well. Shadow of the Cat is different. Kiss of the Vampire is different. And all of these are interesting in some way, apart from arguably Evil of Frankenstein, which is easily the worst of the Frankenstein movies. Gorgon is really interesting. So, you know, interesting period. And lots of these are collected on the limited edition box sets, Hammer volumes 1 to 6. They've got titles like Hammer Faces of Fear, Volume 4. They very much collect these Columbia movies. Those are gorgeous box sets, by the way. I'll talk about those on a future video. Next era is what I'm calling the All Guns Blazing Fox 7 Arts era. This is where they had this three-way deal, the brainchild of Carreras, working with his favorites, US contact, Elliot Hyman at 7 Arts, and Fox, you know, solid distributor, who apparently were pretty good at marketing these films as well. And here, I think that there's a slight tick up in exploitation in these films. And there's a slight tick up as well in, dare I say, a bit of sensationalism. They lose some of that romance, some of the gothic feel. It becomes much more like this, right? We are the horror factory. We are the monster factory here. But they are really all in, guns blazing. I mean, they start out with this audacious, four films back to back to back. Dracula, Prince of Darkness, Plague of the Zombies, Rasputin, Reptile, all made back to back at Bray. Their final films at Bray, and they go out with a bang there. 1 million years BC was a huge hit. The Witches is really interesting film. Frankenstein Created Woman is really interesting film. Quatermass and the Pit is a classic. Devil Rides Out is arguably the best of all the Hammer films. Dracula Has Risen from the Grave is really good. Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed is a knockout, probably the best of the Frankenstein film. Taste the Blood of Dracula, arguably the best of the Dracula films, apart from the first one. I would take Taste of the Blood of Dracula. I got fond, I like Roy Kinnear in it and things like that. And I also like the weird plot with the three libertines getting punished and things like that. So this arguably is one of the strongest periods. And I think Hammer fans often argue about when was the peak of the studio. Some people say the peak was the classic era, Frankenstein, Dracula, Mummy. Those three films is the artistic peak. Other people argue, actually, the studio peaked here with Devil's Rides Out coming right in the middle. But this is a hot streak, whichever way you look at it. I haven't quite decided what I think, but there's definitely a lot of good stuff here as well. Then we get the final Blaze of Glory era, early 70s. Lots of these films, despite their release dates, were actually sorted out. The finance part was sorted out by James Karinas before he left. But there's a lot of films here that are highly rated by horror fans. The Karnstein trilogy, which I've talked about, the kind of lesbian vampire stuff. Countess Dracula is an interesting film. Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde is an interesting film. Hands of the Ripper is highly rated. Vampire Circus is mental. Fear of the Night is highly rated. Satanic Rites of Dracula is, in my view, underrated. Not as bad as it seems, actually. It's kind of like a kind of Dracula as a James Bond villain, as mad as that sounds. But it's better than it sounds, actually. Lots of pretty solid movies here, despite the fact that there was all this turmoil going on backstage. They actually churned out a lot of good stuff, the final Blaze of Glory. And a lot of Hammer fans may even put in a kind of backdoor argument for this being the peak of the studio. I wouldn't quite put this up there with the other two eras that get talked about. I mean, some fans would even argue for this Columbia era being the peak, but they would be more kind of niche or discerning types, I think, would argue that. And then finally, there is the Bitter End era, where Michael Carreras basically struggles to get anything made, and what does come out basically flops or struggles to get distribution deals. Captain Kronos, for example, highly underrated film, much better than its box office suggested. It's just that they struggled to get it shown, really, especially in America, where it died. It's not that these are bad films, these ones at the end. It's just that they struggled to get them shown. Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell, A Swan Song for Terence Fisher, Peter Cushing as Frankenstein, and really for Hammer Horror as a whole. That film was actually made in 1972, and it has a melancholy feel because Cushing had just lost his wife around that point. And apparently he was a changed man after that and became quite religious as well. It's got a kind of melancholy air in general, that particular one. All right, so those are the eras of Hammer. I'll just go through them one last time. Classic Gothic era, experimental Columbia era, all guns blazing Fox 7 Arts era, final blaze of glory era, the bitter end. Those are the eras of Hammer. I mean, if you disagree, let me know why in the comments. Final thing I'm going to look at in this quite long video is a guide to Hammer guides. Like I said at the start, this topic is a mountain. It's an absolute mountain. And this video should serve as standing right at the foot of the mountain, looking at the path and trying to decide, well, what's the best path to navigate this huge mountain? And there are a number of books that I would recommend. First, the Little Shop of Horror magazine, fanzine, been going since 1972. They're all available to buy on Amazon. Some of them are freely available on Kindle if you have a subscription to that, or you can get them on Kindle for a bit of a lower price. I don't know, there's been like 50 or so, so they don't come out, you know, they come like once a year or once every other year or whatever, but they are packed with information, interviews. This guy, the editor, really knows his stuff. Arguably, he is the foremost Hammer expert in the world, and it is arguable because there are so many guys who really know their stuff on this particular topic. But yeah, Little Shop of Horrors magazine has been going for a long time, and it seems like it had a good working relationship with all of the core cast and crew. So there's lots of information in there that is only available in that magazine through those interviews. Another person who arguably is the foremost Hammer fan in the entire world, or expert in the world, is Wayne Kinsey. He also ran a fanzine. But his key contribution is in this trilogy of books, Hammer Films, The Bray Studio Years, the direct follow-on Hammer Films, The Elstree Studio Years, and then the rather mammoth Hammer Films, The Unsung Heroes, where you've got everything from like biographies of the T-Boy, you know, it's ridiculously in-depth. So Wayne Kinsey's trilogy of books there. And I would say he is in contention for being the foremost Hammer expert in the world. But it's a crowded field, as we're about to see, because another really good book is by this chap, Marcus Hearn, who is a Hammer Films historian. And he wrote The Hammer Story, The Authorized History of Hammer Films. Now, he's made a lot of documentaries. He crops up on a lot of DVD extras, as you can see here. And he would certainly, I think, put himself forward as the foremost Hammer horror expert in the world. So, I mean, if there was three, it would definitely be these three chaps that I've just mentioned. But yet there's more books that I've got here that have been, you know, I've barely scratched the surface in this video, to be honest. But, you know, I've consulted all of them to give you the information that I have so far. There's also the Hammer Films Exhaustive Filmography by Tom Johnson and Deborah Del Vecchio. That's a sizable tome. There's the Encyclopedia of Hammer Films by Chris Fellner. And Howard Maxford's Hammer Complete, The Films, The Personnel, The Company. Now, these three books basically all do the same job, but there's some information that you'll find in one that's not in the other. They're kind of reference books. Not cheap, any of these, by the way. So, you know, expect to shell out if you're going to collect them all. But yeah, there's tons of information in these. I mean, it really is. When they say exhaustive, there's so much stuff. You know, this is one of those rabbit holes that never ends, basically. You never get to the end of the Hammer rabbit hole, as I discovered making this video. Now, in terms of videos and documentaries, this man, Jonathan Rigby, who wrote a book called English Gothic, A Century of Horror Cinema, Any DVD extras involving him, I have found, have been very good. He tends to crop up on the aforementioned box sets that I mentioned, the 6-volume one, those limited editions. He's also on the 21-disc, the Hammer collection. He's on most of those extras too. When it's the DVD that involves him, it's usually a high-quality extra. You know, they're only like 20 minutes long, half an hour, but I found them extremely informative. Another guy who crops up on those extras is Mark Gatiss, you know, of League of Gentlemen fame, who's also got a documentary, a more general documentary on horror, that is worth checking out. There's a bit on Hammer in there as well. He's pretty knowledgeable as well. There's another chap who crops up called David Huckvale, who talks about the scores and the James Bernard's avant-garde influences and things like that. All of these fellows are terribly posh, by the way, which is possibly one of the reasons why I like those DVD extras quite a lot, that there's this kind of feel about them all talking about these Hammer films. So, yeah, just DVD extras on those sets, I would say, is a definite goldmine of information. Some of those sets are pretty hard to get hold of, and I'll talk about that in a future video. Now, another thing that is unbelievably good, and when I say unbelievably good, is Crabapple's coverage of Hammer on his Look and Look Again season 4. This playlist here, he starts in 1955 and he runs right through to the end. He covers not every single film, but basically all of the major films. He gives you information, he reviews them. It is just extraordinary. I mean, it's about 10 hours long. You can see this video is almost 2 hours long. He goes for 10 hours and he goes through every single film. And I would say that on YouTube, that is the gold standard in terms of coverage of Hammer's back catalogue. Crabapple has outdone himself. He's a little bit unusual. Obviously he's a massive horror nerd and he's got a couple of strange verbal tics. But once you get used to him, once you get used to the kind of flow of that series and you get used to his personality, it is just so good, that series. And also, along the way, he kind of complains a few times about the woke and so on, making me think that not a bad chap either. Also not bad at all is Dark Corner Reviews, Hammer Reviews. He mainly covers the Frankenstein franchise and the Dracula franchise. But his takes are generally quite good, I would say. And not bad production values on those videos either. Now, I did do a panoramic sweep of all of the kind of Hammer content, top tens and people talking about Hammer on YouTube. It's a bigger field than you'd imagine. And if any of you guys drop in to watch this video, hello, by the way, I've kind of watched all of your stuff. I'll just say that the best ones are pretty good. The worst ones are appalling, just appalling. Yes, I think I picked out the creme de la creme here. Another thing definitely worth watching is the Flesh and Blood, the Hammer Heritage of Horror retrospective. You can get it on YouTube. I actually bought it on Amazon Prime and then realized it was on YouTube and I was like, oh, I wasted a fiver there. But it's on Amazon Prime, or you can get it here on YouTube as well. And basically this incorporates all of the choice footage from a 1987 documentary that was made called, I think it was called like Hammer Horror, The House That Dripped Blood or something like that, which was an older documentary. But this basically takes all of that material, updates it, adds new stuff, and is, you know, a very good one-shot stop shop on Hammer. And like I said, my claims of being definitive are ropey, to say the least. I mean, I hope I've done a good job, but as I hope I've shown as well, there is so much stuff out there that, you know, I just like to be in the conversation, to be honest. So hopefully I've not outstayed my welcome. Like I said, there'll be two follow-up videos to this where I pick out my Hammer top 10, Hammer horror films, and also where I give you a brief guide to collecting Hammer on DVD and Blu-ray. Those will be follow-ups. Suffice it to say for the end of this video, if you are a virgin, if you've not watched any of these movies, I implore you to check some of them out. If you, like me, happen to catch some when you were growing up on TV, you know, on a rainy Sunday night or something, or 1 a.m. BBC Two, as they were often shown, I would encourage you to go back and check out some of these films, especially some of the lesser known ones. It's a surprisingly robust and strong catalogue. We're talking about 100 films here. And even I would say when Hammer hit under, they're never like truly crap. There's something quality about the Hammer productions. One of the things I will say also is that with the HD and the Blu-ray now, they really look fantastic. You know, the colours pop on these films. I especially think this is true of the films of the late 1950s and the early 1960s. For whatever reason, those earlier ones from the classic period, they just look brilliant. You know, sometimes with the Blu-ray transfers, they almost do it too well, where you can see all the makeup lines and things. That doesn't seem to happen on the Hammer productions. They just look fantastic. The Mummy in particular, just a gorgeous film, as is Curse of Frankenstein and the original Dracula too. And in fact, one of the things I found when I was doing my survey for the purposes of this video was that after about 1965-66, I find that the colours kind of get a bit more washed out. I don't know what the reason for that, whether it was the Technicolor in the late 50s and there was a difference in the actual film technology they were using. But some of the films of the later 60s don't look as good as the ones from the late 50s, certainly in my view. Probably the worst looking of the major films is, in my opinion, Scars of Dracula from 1970. Not only does the bat just look naff and stupid, but there's something about that whole film that looks cheaper than the rest of them. So that was probably the worst looking of all of the movies that I can remember. But as on the whole, hopefully you can see from the clips I'm showing you here, they look great. Another thing that I wanted to say before wrapping up is that I think it's a mistake to think in terms of something dating or something, you know, having been surpassed in some way, which is sometimes how people look at film or how people think of horror. For example, they say, well, yes, you know, Hammer was fine, but then along came The Exorcist and along came Halloween and the slasher movies, or along came Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Night of the Living Dead, and Hammer was passé, or Hammer was old hat, or after those things, we don't need to bother with Hammer anymore. And I just generally think that is a kind of wrong-headed way of approaching art in the first place. But in the case of Hammer, I would also say it's a bit of a miscategorization. I'm not even sure if horror is necessarily the right category for many of these films, which is something that both Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee said many times in their interviews. They didn't really see what they were doing as horror, but rather as a kind of dark fantasy or a fairy tale. Terence Fisher talked about this as well. You know, the gothic part, they weren't engaged in just trying to shock you. There's something about these films that, to me, takes you to a different place. And they really do create this different world. You know, the village that they create in Bray there, it transports you to a different time, a different place, a different sensibility. There's a romance to it. There's a kind of mystique around the whole thing. And, I mean, for me, there's a bit of nostalgia and coziness with Hammer as well. But, yeah, it's not, I mean, horror, do these films scare you, is not really the right question. For me, they create these other worlds, these romantic worlds, and that is the way in which I'd approach them, rather than seeing them through the lens of quote-unquote horror. All right, well, hope you enjoyed this. Let me know your memories of Hammer in the comments. Let me know what you thought of this, and I'll see you next time. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.